Welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode 192. So, if you have any questions or comments, you feel free to leave them on the comments section of Podbean, or you can email them to me at kbmakel@aol.com. I did get one comment. The cheap equipment I use, the suggestion was, hey, you better check your ground because we're getting a hum over it. I'm not really picking up a hum, but I don't exactly have the best hearing in the world. So I will endeavor to work on that. I actually use a headset that USBs into my computer. So I don't know, you know, if it's a little wiring problem inside the headset or something else. But anyway, or it may be just my raspy voice creates a hum. I'm not sure. But anyway, appreciate the comments because it does help, and I will look into that. Lots of interesting things. Everybody's heard about the court case where the parents of a school shooter have basically been convicted and sentenced for involuntary manslaughter. You know, and again, this is one of those bad situations. I would sit there and kind of look at this, and I really didn't know what to think. I mean, number one, I'm totally obviously against that kind of violence and all those things, but it's a very complex situation. How much responsibility do the parents have in a situation like that? And I'm not sure. They did buy the firearm. And the amount of access and other things, did they have it locked up? I'm not sure about. These are all questions, and you can litigate all that over and over and over again. I don't see where it's constitutional. I think it's going to get overturned somewhere, sometime. I think they're going to essentially become exonerated, because charging someone who's not a direct accessory, like, you know, the getaway car driver, you know, that person's part of the crime. These people weren't part of the crime, and I would assume, unless they have proof to the contrary, which is, I'm sure they don't, is that had they known something like this would happen, they would have prevented it. They would have taken steps to prevent it. They did not aid and abet or assist in the crime. I'm sure that they were unwitting parties to this. And so what are they really guilty of? Well, according to the prosecution, it's they knew the child was mentally ill. They didn't get the child the shooter. I'll use that maybe. They didn't get the shooter any treatment. And of course, they had a firearm, and I don't know if they had it secured or not. I assume that it was probably not secured in a locked cabinet or anything, which is, you know, the other form of gun control that they want to put on is you have to lock everything up. But as guns come with trigger locks anymore, you know, I mean, they put the cheap trigger lock in, which would have prevented this, probably. You know, they're maybe not a bad idea to use. You know, if it keeps you out of legal jeopardy like this, you should put them on. But you know, it's one of those things. How much responsibility do they bear? And it'll be interesting, because now we can start talking about, well, what about all the gang members who go out and shoot people, like the people at the Super Bowl parade that just happened? Where are they? How are their parents going to be held accountable? Is the single mothers in the inner cities going to be held accountable because, well, they knew that their wayward teenage son had a firearm, or at least access to a firearm, or they suspected such and they took no action? They took no action to get this person out of the gang. They took no action. So this opens an incredible can of worms that will blow up in the you could use in any inner city shooting case that involves somebody under the age of 18 or so. So it'll be interesting to see if they push that. Yeah, it's a lot easier to hit the couple in the school shooting, but what about all the rest of the violence where the parents know? And I think they're on shaky legal ground saying, well, the teenager was mentally ill, the shooter was mentally ill. Okay. First of all, parents, they may see signs, but they're not mental health professionals, and they can't diagnose anything. And the other thing is, how many teenagers, just because of drama and the fact that they're going through changes, biological changes in life and all this, how many teenagers don't have problems or don't at one point or another exhibit, some emotional distress? I would say that most teenagers on some at some point at some time do. And how do you cope with that? A lot of times you say hey, they'll grow out of it. It's a phase or whatever else. And maybe they thought that's what this case was, that their kid was just going through a phase. The other thing I always go back to is it always seems that perpetrators of school violence, and I don't call it school shootings, I call it school violence, that school violence always leads back to a kid who is socially not integrated into the rest of the school. They're an outcast. They are, they're on the periphery. They're kind of these outliers. It's not the head cheerleader, it's not the football team quarterback. It's the kid who doesn't really participate in anything, is not in any kind of social circle, that's it, not in a popular social circle. And I would also say that they are, literally picked on and bullied to the point where they want to go kill their classmates. I mean, I think that's, if you kind of look at school shooters, I think you would see that as a trend. Is it universal? Well, probably not, but maybe I think there's enough of it. Every one of these that's there is seems to have all this in common, and the bullying now can extend to social media and all the rest of this. So, I don't know. I don't know what the one answer to school violence is: increased security, which nobody wants to talk about, but is actually the best idea. It really is the best idea. The next awesome thing that they have to do is when they see that a kid, maybe there has to be some sort of intervention. If the school is providing the environment where this bullying can take place, then maybe there needs to be some sort of a mechanism that can intervene and stop that behavior. I can't imagine what it must be like to go to school and get bullied every day. And that's where a lot of these school shooters and school violence perpetrators, that's what they're coming from. And I'm not saying the teachers need to raise the they need to raise the children, but they do need to provide a safe environment. And psychological abuse is, it's like physical abuse. I mean, it's abuse, and yet they allow it to happen. They're powerless to stop it. That's probably, allowing it to happen is probably an offshoot of they're powerless to stop it, because we don't empower. Somehow teachers have been empowered to have hormone therapy and transgender affirming, all of this stuff is somehow in the schools now, and teachers have the authority to do this, and a kid can go get, this all these kind of hormone and puberty blockers and all of this. They can get all that without their parental permission, but they can't seem to stop school bullying. That seems to be strange to me. Very, very strange. And I don't understand why this is kind of happening. You know, our schools are kind of drifting off into a strange place, but they've got to increase security. They've got to do something to stop bullying and create a little better environment. And I realize kids will be kids, and bullying is kind of something that happens. But giving them the old advice of, well, if you stand up to a bully, they'll shrink down. Yeah, after they beat you half to death, you know. I mean, especially nowadays, kids have, and it's not all kids, of course. It's just a small subsection, but there isn't the fear of any authority, even the police. Even the police. Did you see the case? I think it was in Philadelphia, where three teenage girls basically beat to death an older mentally disabled man. I mean, wow, who would have ever thought that three teenage girls would do something like that? That's phenomenal. That is beyond. If you wrote that as the screenplay for a TV movie or something, nobody would believe it. People would say, that's just ridiculous. But yet it has happened. It has happened. And it's part of this societal aberrant behavior that we have come to tolerate. You know, it's again, to go back to people bringing all kinds of weapons to a Super Bowl parade is crazy. It's crazy. You can understand. I don't endorse. Nobody endorses this, but you can understand. Okay, gangs with, you know, turf wars because of, you know, the crime they're in, whether they're selling drugs or whatever else. You can kind of understand those clashes, but just to say, hey, we're going to the Super Bowl parade. Everybody carrying. You know, I mean, that is at a different level. Our society is at a much more dangerous and different level. And of course, our government is doing nothing. They want to restrain and, you know, defund and restrain the police. So the people who are out there protecting us now don't have the tools to protect us. They're not allowing them to do it. And it's showing. It's the fabric of our society. People have said this for a long time. They've gone back 50 years and said this, but the fabric of our society is just tearing. You know, it's like there's being a big hole being worn in it. Some of the, you know, the common decency rules that everybody obeyed are now either gone or they're eroding quickly. And it's a dangerous time and a dangerous place. Meanwhile, some good news is apparently the exemption from the pistol brace ban, that apparently extends now to all paid up NRA members because they're part of the lawsuit, which is a good thing. That's a very good thing. SBR should never be illegal anyway. They never should have been regulated or controlled. It was just an anomaly of the, you know, the most heinous piece of legislation in U.S. history, the Federal Firearms Act of 1934, which, you know, really needs to be, if not totally eliminated, at least have its most onerous provisions removed. Of course, if this lawsuit against that ban goes bad, I suppose they'll be out looking for these things. They will go to every, you know, every manufacturer of these things. They'll get their records. They'll find out who bought them, and or who has sold these things, and they'll show up at your house. They did with those. Remember those solvent traps that were really and many people thought they were an unfinished silencer. And perhaps they were. I think they actually legally made one into a silencer and found out it wasn't very effective. So, you know, whatever it is, it is. But yeah, they were knocking on people's doors looking for those things. They figured out who bought them and basically said, "Hey, you know, we catch you with this, it's gonna be bad." But you know, hopefully that the, you know, if they want to defund somebody, defund the ATF. And I think they're about, I did read an article where they're going to take some sort of a cut. I'll investigate it and see if that's really the case. Oh, another interesting thing is I finally got around to watching Masters of the Air, about the 8th Air Force and specifically the 100th Bomb Group in Europe during World War II. The acting didn't quite measure up. It seemed a little forced to me. It just didn't have that natural flair to it. It just didn't seem as authentic as the Band of Brothers was. But you know, be that as it may, it was an excellent series. Understand they have to use CGI because I think there are only 10 or 15 flyable B-17s scattered around the world at this point. So, you know, they're not going to be able to show a giant formation of them. It's going to involve some of their cinematic trickery to get those kind of shots in the deal. But it was excellent, and it again goes to show you the immense debt we owed that generation. And by and large, they're gone. By and large, they're gone. But it's really amazing when you see the sacrifice, the hard work and everything. Guys who were in there, you know, the prime of their youth, where they should have been having fun. Subsequent generations had a lot of fun. You know, it's amazing what they did for us and how they sacrificed so that we had a better world. And that's really the thing you take from it. And it is an outstanding masterpiece. There's no two ways about it. It will be famous. Like I said, the acting got better towards the end, but it never really hit that note of authenticity with me that the other ones did. So that is basically that. And now we can get into some of the questions and answers. Okay, our first question comes from listener Michael, and his question is about, it concerns the issuance of handguns to the troops. And I have to summarize this because he wrote, it's a very detailed inquiry. So I'll have to kind of, you know, break it into some chunks and go with it that way. And it says, "I understand that handguns are only issued to officers, NCOs, and specialized units. I always thought handguns should be issued to all troops, especially frontline troops. I understand the weight is an issue and that lightweight handguns are presently being issued. I would suspect that having the extra security of a handgun would be worth the extra weight." That's very true. It's true that they're issued to people by position, and it's generally officers, senior NCOs, and in specialized units. When I was in the Army Special Operations Command, we had a rule that you had two weapons. You had a sidearm, and you had a primary weapon, which was an M4 carbine. So you had an M9 pistol and an M4 carbine. And that was pretty much across the command in, you know, when you were in the theater of operations. So that's how that basically worked. As far as all troops go, I don't know of any army that successfully did that. Later on, there was a, in World War, well, let's go back to the beginning of revolvers and of military handguns. The single shotguns, hey, those were just officers. They usually carried them in pairs. They were very expensive, privately procured. That's just a generality. I know that there are some exceptions, but that's basically it. When revolvers came out, they realized the firepower advantage of having five or six shots compared to the single shot muzzle loading weapons that they had, you know. So, in the Civil War, you would have Confederate raiders and guerrillas and cavalry. They would a lot of times carry two, four, or even sometimes even as many as six revolvers on their person, simply because you couldn't really reload them. They were cap and ball revolvers. You couldn't reload them, so you carried more of them, and it gave you respectable firepower. 25 shots in an era of single shot muzzle loading long arms is a pretty good deal. So that was kind of close. The cavalry and the raiders and all that would have that. Go moving up to World War I, and we have Pershing said all the troops need a sidearm, and but there was just not the production capacity to make that happen. I think that in World War I, in the trenches, like in the French army, they were buying handguns from whoever would sell them to them. Basically, they were getting Spanish ones. They bought some from Colt. They bought some from all kinds of different sources. A lot of 32 ACP, which they would call 765 Browning. And how they issued those out, I'm not sure, but I'm sure they pretty liberally gave them out. Again, having a six or seven, or maybe even an eight-shot automatic pistol. They also use Savage 1907 pistols too. Having something like that, in addition to the rifle that. And a lot of times the French had three-shot Berthier rifles. It had a little, a kind of a clip that went into the top of the rifle, much like a Garand clip, but it only held three rounds, and then it would fall out the bottom when it was empty. That, and they had the Lebel, which had the tube loading. So having a backup handgun was great, and they bought them. How they issued them out, I don't know, but I'm fairly certain that it wasn't a one for one, that every man had one. Maybe every couple of guys had one. Whatever it was. And that's simply because there just wasn't the capacity to manufacture them as quickly as they could. Again, the US Army thought everybody should have one. Well, US Army in the persona of General Pershing, that was a request he put in, but again, they just couldn't make them fast enough. They didn't have enough, and they couldn't make them fast enough. So that never happened. Then it goes on. I read an article about World War II soldiers. One had a 38. A lot, and the reason that's important is there were some 38 caliber revolvers used in the Second World War. Aviators had them. It was basically Smith & Wesson Model 10, called the Victory Model. Really excellent pistol. But supplemental to that, and this probably happened in World War I to a degree also, soldiers would bring or have shipped to them a commercial revolver from home, or a commercial automatic pistol from home. That was, I think a lot of people turned a blind eye to that. It definitely was not in the official channels that you could do that or anything, but I believe that, like a lot of things in a combat zone, a lot of the peacetime rules were a blind eye was turned to that, and so nobody would say anything. So you if your family sent you one, you could probably keep it and use it, and it would probably work out pretty well. And he mentioned that it was passed from soldier to soldier. If somebody got wounded or went home for whatever reason, got sick, however it happened, it would go to someone else. Band of Brothers discussed paratroopers being issued sidearms. Again, I don't think it was universal. As a matter of fact, I'm certain it was not. But again, they probably had a higher density. And a lot of the rules kind of go out the window. So if you could talk somebody into issuing you one, you could carry it, and nobody would probably say a thing. So that's they were there, but not everybody had one. And it goes to there's a scene where somebody gets a package from home, and it's a 1911, a commercial 1911 in there. And if all paratroopers were issued 1911s, why would the scene concerning the gift revolver Oh, I'm sorry, he got a revolver in the package. Why would the scene concerning the gift revolver be of importance? Well, it wouldn't. Because it would be of importance because not everybody was issued a sidearm, and he was lucky enough to get one. There's another example, the book Kurahi, which is actually an excellent book. As a combat veteran of the 101st Airborne Division, not obviously in World War II, but much, much, much later, it's really interesting. Really interesting how they've portrayed all that, and you get that inside story. And so, yeah, they had that, and he talked about he's the one who got the nickel-plated 1911 from his father, who got it from a police officer. And you know, he's that there were great guns. There is no two ways about that. During World War One, that's when they wanted to give everybody one. Never could make it happen. Troops in the Gulf-Iraq War. Special Operations Command is the only one I saw that had and carried two weapons. The rest... Now, there were other people who had sidearms, obviously, but I think universally issued, the only people I know of in the Iraq War were... Special Operations Command. Gulf War, probably not even so much. Some of the top tier Special Operations units probably did, but not everybody did, even in the rest of the Special Operations Command. I was not in the military, but I'm the opinion all troops should be issued a sidearm. And then there's stories about somebody who, you know, essentially, you know, in places like Vietnam, hey, you go off to do something, you know, whether it's to go off and pee or whatever else, and you don't have your primary weapon, but you got the sidearm, and something unexpected happens, hey, you're armed. There's no two ways about that. One of the recommendations that I made that nobody paid attention to, because I was too low to be listened to, was when we had all these incidents of, hey, you're training Afghans, you're training Iraqis, and you know they turn around and start shooting up the you know, our allies, quote unquote, start shooting us up. You know, some guy goes kind of crazy, or he goes into a place where they're American, like in a gym or something. There's been all kinds of incidents like that, and I thought that, you know what, they should issue a lot of people. Start a program where you train people and, you know, issue them something small like a Chief Special or a Walther PPK or something that you would have on you that would be relatively surreptitious, but it would be there just in case something like that happened. So I agree, everybody should have something. However, I don't think most, the importance of a military pistol has somewhat waned, and I don't think we'll see that importance return. It's interesting to note, and I actually have one of these, that in World War One, British officers were not issued a rifle. They were issued a handgun, a Webley handgun. A good handgun, you know, solid stopper, 4.55. But in addition to that, many of them privately procured small 32 caliber automatics to keep as a backup for their sidearm. So they carried actually two handguns, because, hey, when your revolver's empty, you may not have time to reload it, and the extra, just the firepower of a 32 caliber handgun would be great. I have a Webley 1907. It's a little boxy looking, kind of. When you first look at it, you go, is that really a gun? I mean, it's really kind of very kind of a primitive looking automatic, but it works. And I read one account where an officer said, you know, that's a good thing to buy, and for a frontline tour, if you have the handgun and two loaded magazines, you're going to be good to go, because you're not going to be firing it that much. You shouldn't be. So that's an interesting, a very, very interesting question. I think that when you look at And again, this is where you go back to weight. When you look at what people have to carry, just you have to make compromises. And you know, when you load a guy down with 75 to maybe even 100 pounds of stuff, it's tough. I mean, carrying a 1911, which is not a light handgun, and a machine gun and ammunition and all these other good things, that's quite a burden. That's quite a burden. And you can save a few pounds by not carrying a pistol and ammunition. And you do the trade-off. You hope your assistant gunner or gunners and ammo bearer, with their rifles, because they're all going to have rifles, that they're going to protect you. That you have a machine gun to protect you, and you have these guys with their rifles. So a handgun, the additional weight may not be worth it to you, especially if you're doing a long movement on foot. There's also the, you know, just the question of complications. Just the more stuff you hang on your body, the less agile you are. So there's a lot to be said for not having the additional encumbrance of, and that goes to things like binos and gas mask. You know, when you put binoculars, gas mask, a sidearm, and all this stuff on people, and then you issue them their primary weapon and all that, that starts to become a real problem. That's why lighter weight handguns, I like the question because it really kind of focuses, hey, lighter weight handguns might be a really good option, that you don't need the 18 round service automatic. You don't need that. Maybe if you have something smaller, less powerful, but hey, it really doesn't take up any additional weight. There's no meaningful weight. Maybe that's not a bad thing to have just as an emergency backup. That would be a very good idea. Will they ever do it? I doubt it. But I think it's a very, very good idea. Part of the reason they won't do it is because little small things like that would get lost. They would get misplaced. Unlike the large service automatic, which is kind of like a boat anchor, you know. But I like the idea. I wish I had had something like that. My handgun was a an M9, which is a good handgun. But and I carried it in. I tried a variety of ways to do it, depending on where I was and what I was doing. The one I liked was the Bianchi. No, it's not a Bianchi. I guess it was a Bianchi shoulder holster. No, it was Galco. That was it. I still got it someplace. But the Galco shoulder holster was really nice. Had magazines on one side, the gun on the other, so they kind of balanced. Mine was the one that was vertical. Because they made everybody stop using the ones where it was, you know, horizontal, where it was pointed back, because they just didn't like that. So you had to get the vertical one if you're going to use something like that. So and you could carry that, you know, everywhere. I took mine everywhere. Everywhere I was, it went with me. You know, that's just the way it is. It becomes a part of you. And so, you know, we could very well do that, but a very insightful question and very, very interesting. You know, how many weapons do you really want? How many do you need? What's that magic? What's that sweet spot between the weapons you carry and want and the amount of weight you can actually carry and also the amount of complexity you can manage? That's a lot what this is. But definitely just to go back, since I'm a historical person, 1911s and 1917 revolvers were good sidearms to have in World War I. They were really good because you had up close range, powerful, reliable handguns. But they were not small. But had Pershing had his way, everybody would have had something. Everyone would have had something. When you look at actually production numbers of sidearms compared to long arms, they're just dwarfed by the capacity. And I always wondered why that was. And then I kind of realized when wartime production expands, there's a problem. And I wasn't really appreciating this problem until I kind of was researching and reading about it. The problem is a lot of your skilled workers kind of get called away. You know, you can't protect everybody, so you're training new workers to assemble something complicated like a revolver, and your experienced employees, that pool is getting smaller and smaller as some of them get, you know, naturally people are going to kind of cycle out. People are going to get sick. People are going to, you know, perhaps die suddenly. People are going to get called into military service. You can't protect them all. And it's amazing how this could really impact production. And it did so with rifles, and it was a struggle to get people who could, you know, build the rifles. And it had to been an even bigger struggle to do that for something as complicated as revolvers. And so it's really a interesting question, really something that makes you sit down and want to think. You know, it shows you that preparation is better than reaction. Okay, the next one is not actually in the form of a question. Our friend of the podcast has procured a Smith & Wesson Model 15 revolver, which is a K-frame, Smith & Wesson K-frame, medium frame revolver with adjustable sights, and they usually almost universally have a 4-inch barrel. They are excellent. It's one of my favorite revolvers. They are excellent revolvers. They shoot very well. What I really like about it is even a person who's not an enthusiastic shooter can usually do pretty well with it because it has good sights, good trigger pull. It's not too big. It doesn't have too much recoil. It's really a very, very nice blend of power, size, good features like trigger pull and sights. It was such a good revolver that the Air Force, I think they call them APs, Air Police, used it for decades. I think they've moved on to something else now, but they are really excellent revolvers. I like them much better than the Model 10, you know, the fixed sight ones. I have nothing against those, but I really like the adjustable sights on the 15, and it's just an outstanding gun. So I would say that, you know, that's a, if you can find one, and they're usually not horribly expensive. I mean, they're not horribly expensive. You know, most 38 revolvers, 38 special revolvers, are kind of looked at as, well, being very pedestrian and being very, you know, kind of a workman type thing. Not really very exciting. But they are an outstanding option if you want to actually want to hit something and actually want to be effective and need that balance of power and weight. The Model 15 was magnetized, you know, for 357 Magnum and became the Model 19, which was an outstanding revolver, you know, powerful for its size and everything. It did have, the early ones did have a problem of kind of beating themselves up a little bit when fed a steady diet of magnums, but it really, really was a, you know, if you had to go with what was kind of the ultimate police revolver, the Model 19 was probably it. That was probably it for a long time. So, all right, we will go now to the next question. And that is, what is your opinion of the AR-15A2, the civilian equivalent of the M16A2? Well, I think it's an outstanding rifle. I mean, it really, if you want a service configuration AR-15, the most accurate one to get is the A2. You know, the most accurate, not in replication, but in actual terms of accuracy. They will shoot really, really well. I like them very much. Now, you pay for that in weight. The A2 buttstock is a little bit, it's like an inch longer, so it's longer. It feels much more like a traditional rifle than the M16A1 or M4, AR-15 or M4 clones that we had on the civilian side. It feels much more like a rifle. It's balanced. It's just longer. It does not feel like a select fire weapon. It feels more like a traditional rifle. So there you are. It's really good. I like mine particularly. I put an ACOG on the top of it, and that just shoots well. And it's the fixed carry handle. Nothing fancy. No match trigger. Nothing. I do have a barrel that's a little thicker under the handguard than a standard A2. That was just the configuration I was able to buy at the time. So it's not an exact. If you weighed it with an M16A2, mine would come out a little heavier. But no, they're absolutely outstanding rifles. The rear sight, the whole thing is just a great package. Very, very good if you want to hit out at longer range. So, and it was designed by, the design was inspired and probably assisted by USMC marksmen who wanted to turn the M16 into a more accurate rifle to reflect their belief in longer range accurate rifle fire. So that's what you got, and it was very good. When I first saw it, I really liked it. I thought it was just great, the M16A2. As I've gone through time, I do think that as good as the A2 is, that the M4, for especially the War on Terror and fighting in you know, the built up areas and things like that, that the M4 is really an outstanding piece of equipment. The only thing I don't like about the A2, and this does not really apply to most civilian shooters, is that if you're wearing body armor or a flak jacket, I had one with a flak jacket in Bosnia, and you could not get a stock weld on it. You couldn't see through the sights. The flak jacket was too bulky. So it was a whole lot better to, you actually had to open your flak jacket and get the butt in next to your shoulder. And that was the only way you could kind of do it. It really didn't. The equipment was not all designed to work well. The adjustable buttstock of the M4 cured that. So there you go. There are, they've kind of fooled with it. There's the M16A4, which has the removable handguard, and it's got a fixed buttstock. But I think I've seen versions that have an adjustable buttstock. So it's, they've kind of fooled with it. But that 20-inch heavier barrel with good sights, that concept of the AR-15 is still very viable and still quite excellent. So I would say that's still a very, very usable and very, very enjoyable weapon to use. So I really like it, but it is somewhat different than the M4. It's like the difference between an M1 Garand and an M4. You know, they're both great, but they are very different. Here's the next one. This comes from someone who kind of approached me in person. What is your opinion of the Mexican 1910 Mauser? Is it as good as rifles that were made in Europe? I have to tell you, I believe it is. I believe it's actually an outstanding Mauser. It's essentially a Mauser 98 with a fairly simple ladder rear sight and 7mm Mauser. And it has very pleasant recoil. It's, it's still a long rifle. I mean, I think it's got it doesn't have a 29-inch barrel, but it's got a fairly long barrel. They made them from 1910 to about 1935, and I think they only made about 40,000 of them, so it wasn't a high-volume factory. They were all used through the Mexican Revolutionary periods and periods of upheaval, and apparently about half of them, about 20,000 of them, were shipped to Spain for the Spanish Civil War in the late 1930s. And they would have been on the, not the General Franco side, but the king, the Republic, I think that's the Republicans. So there were a bunch of that were sent there. And never heard a bad word about them. There are pictures of Villa's raiders. There's one famous picture where he had there's holding a 1910, and they've cut the some of the wood off it to make it easier to and lighter to handle on horseback, I suppose. But yeah, they were widely used. Very, you know, it has that wonderful Mauser dependability and certainty. You know, every movement you make with it seems to be very positive and very, you know, really very, very precision, very precise. So it's really an excellent rifle and an excellent cartridge. I've always been a big fan of the 7mm Mauser. And so it was, you know, a very modern military rifle during its production time. It was definitely as good as anything else out there in the bolt action realm. So they are understandably a bit rare in the United States. So if you get a chance to grab a hold of one, I would not hesitate because there are just not many of them. Not many were made, and not many hit our surplus market. So there you go. Next question is from the same source. Your opinion of the Soviet M44 carbine, the Mosin-Nagant M44 carbine. I like them. I think with 150 grain service ammunition, their recoil is not that bad. There are a lot of stories about how terrible the recoil is. I think that's from firing the heavy bullet machine gun ammo in them. But it's, you know, they're very, very, they're short and they're very, very agile, very, very practical. They don't, it's not very handy to use, very handy to use. I do not care for folding bayonets. I do not care for bayonets attached to a rifle. I have some, and I mean, I don't dig them. It always seems like, unless you need to fix bayonets, it seems to that it's always kind of in the way, or it's kind of throwing out the throwing off the balance of the gun. So I don't really care. Or it's underneath, and it, you know, you want to put your maybe you want to put your hand there, and you know, you got the back of a folded bayonet that you're dealing with. I just don't care for them. The worst is the VZ-52 rifle, the Czech VZ-52 rifle. That's because that if that bayonet gets a little wonky or gets a little worn, it kind of sticks out, and it's a good way to skewer your hand. So I don't, you know, bayonets were made to stick things, so I don't really need one around my hand all the time. So that's where I am. I collect bayonets. I love bayonets, but I don't really like them as a permanent fixture on my rifle. So kind of leave it at that. But yeah, the M44 is very nice. In Red Dawn, Kansas, we have one lady who shoots one, and she's done exceptionally well. I mean, you know, a lot of guys are looking, and hey, man, she's out there standing, firing 20, 30 rounds out of this thing, and you know, that's a way to get respect because it's awesome. It's very, very awesome. So, yes, very good gun. Okay, here's another one. What do you think of the Springfield M2 22 caliber training rifle? Well, I like all 22 caliber training rifles. I think they're cool. I think they're fun. I enjoy shooting them. I even like the STG 44 22 caliber rifle. It's not really a training rifle at all, but it is a 22 caliber version of a full caliber rifle. So especially a military rifle. So I like them. I will tell you, the first time I picked up an M2, a Springfield Armory M2, is I picked it up. It was in a gun shop, and it just looked beautiful. I picked it up and put it on my shoulder, and the balance was the most. It was perfect balance, and it was the most comfortable rifle to put on your shoulder. I can remember thinking, God, this feels so good. And so, of course, that rifle was not a good fit because it had been drilled for a scope and a few other things. So, of course, that put me on a several-year quest to find one, and I eventually did. And I just still, I marvel when I pick it up how good the quality is, how excellent the balance is. And that's one thing you just don't see. That's one thing that you don't see too much of. Excellent balance in a weapon. There's so many other considerations that go into the design of reliability and manufacturing techniques and all the aspects of design and everything, that when you pick them up and they're not, there's nothing wrong with them, but they don't have that inherent beautiful balance that you would get in sometimes some older rifles that are out there. It just absolutely was amazing to me. It just felt so good. So, like I said, I had to go buy one, and I eventually did. I don't shoot it much, because there's so many other things to do. But I'm planning on basically rectifying that because I really, really like it. And they're still because they fire 22 and it doesn't really wear the bore. They're still outstandingly accurate. I mean, if you're in local, three position small bore rifle leagues, you could still use one and you wouldn't be at a tremendous disadvantage. Now, if you're going to shoot Olympic quality stuff, you will be, but for the most part, you're not going to have a tremendous disadvantage by using that rifle. And it'll definitely turn some heads because they are beautiful. They were made by craftsmen, and there's just no real substitute for that sometimes. There just isn't. I also have a when I shot three position small bore, I really used a Kimber Model 82 Government, the one that could get from the CMP. It's big, it's clunky, it's not as not new, it's very de very very accurate and a very very high quality great weapon, but it is not what the M2 is. That's the It is not what the Springfield M2 is. So yeah, you really come to appreciate it. And sometimes less is more. That the thinner stock, the simple sight, the just the you don't have to worry about making trigger adjustments. It just has a trigger, good trigger. All those things are very, very good. And so that's an excellent excellent rifle. So those are my opinions. I got three or four opinion questions there. Well, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns, a podcast that tells you exactly like it is. Leave comments in the comments section, and or you can email them to me at kbmakel@AOL.com, kbmakel@AOL.com. But until next time, this is Old School Guns out.